Welcome again to the live series online. It's session two. Tim, could you give us a quick recap of session one?
Yeah, so we wrestled with the big question of life. How do we find true happiness, true satisfaction? But for true happiness, it's in the word, it's in the name, you need to wrestle with what is true. Where do we find truth? Is truth whatever you want it to be, wherever you want it to be, or is there kind of a capital T truth out there, an answer to this question? And Jesus claims there is, and that he is actually the true way to true happiness. That was session one.
Yeah, that's where we got started. This week, we've got a question for you to discuss before Tim does his presentation. Have you ever read any of the Bible? And if so, what did you think of it? If you're with people, have a quick chat. If you're watching this by yourself, just have a little think. I'll give you 2 minutes, but pause if you need any longer, and then we'll get right into it. Okay, over to you, Tim.
We live in the age of the hoax, of the scam. Has anyone ever heard of this girl? This is Belle Gibson. She made a business out of having cancer, but then apparently was cured by just living a healthy life. She made thousands of dollars off selling things to people based on what turned out to be a lie. Or maybe you're like me, you've fallen for one of those competitions online, entered in your details, the next thing you know, you get emails every day with fake offers. Can you trust anything anymore? Or sometimes it can be that things can be useful without actually being true. Think about placebos. I find this fascinating. Apparently, colored pills are more likely to relieve pain than plain white pills. Blue pills help people sleep better than red pills. Green capsules are the best bet when it comes to anxiety medication. Isn't that crazy? But it also makes you wonder, what about Christianity? Is Christianity true? Is it just, say, religious therapy, something that makes us feel better but isn't actually true? That's what Sigmund Freud thought. He taught religion, Christianity is a story, it's wishful thinking, it's made up by weak-willed people to help them make sense of life, to find hope in the face of death. Maybe you've thought that once upon a time. Is Christianity a hoax? Is it maybe a placebo? Is everything Jesus said too good to be true? They're the questions I want to wrestle with tonight. And really, all of those things, it all hinges on the Bible. That's what we're going to focus on tonight. I wonder what you think of the Bible. Maybe you've thought something a bit like this.
Re-edited and retranslated and then given to kings for them to take their favorite parts out, and then re-edited and retranslated and then re-edited and then given to the Pope for him to approve, and then re-retranslated, then rewritten, re-edited, retranslated, re-edited again, all based on stories that were told orally 30 to 90 years after they happened to people who didn't know how to write. So... I guess what I'm saying is the Bible is literally the world's oldest game of telephone.
That's comedian David Cross. And there's at least two important questions to ask, I reckon. Firstly, has the Bible been changed over time, edited and so on? And secondly, are the witnesses who wrote the Bible in the first place, are they trustworthy? So I want to consider those with you in a moment, but first, just a little bit of background on the Bible. The Bible isn't one book as such. It's 66 books written over 1,500 years by around 40 different authors in three languages across three continents. But the Christian argument is that it has one unified story. It's made up of two parts, the Old Testament written between 1,500 BC and 400 BC. That concerns the Old Testament's all about the ancient people of Israel, the promises God made to them, and how those promises were worked out in history. And then there's a New Testament. It's much shorter. It's written between probably about 50 AD and 90 AD, and its focus is on Jesus, who he is, and how he actually fulfills all the promises that God made in the Old Testament. Finally, the Bible makes this extraordinarily claim about itself. It's that God stands behind the various human authors. He's overseeing and preserving what they wrote so that we could know the truth about him, ourselves, and our world. So the Bible isn't claiming to be one of many opinions on life. It's claiming to be God's opinion on life, the absolute authority over everyone's life. So last week, we left you with the challenge that you've got to do something with Jesus. He's either a lunatic, a liar, or a lord, as he claimed. But sometimes people wonder if there's a fourth option. Is he simply a legend, a myth? So let's wrestle with that. Let's find that out. First of all, is the Bible reliable, or is it the product of a succession of clever editing, something like Chinese whispers? Have a listen to this guy from Canada explain.
And if we look at the history of this, between the first century, when the New Testament was written, and the fourth century, you have copies of both the Old and the New Testaments being copied and spread around all over the ancient world, so that by the time you get to the fourth century, you have hundreds, if not a few thousand, copies of what we would call the books of the Bible. They were independent at that time. They eventually got stuck into one volume, like we think of a Bible today. But copies of the Gospels, of the Acts, of the Psalms, of the prophets, floating around the ancient world. So that within a few decades and centuries, you have copies up into Europe, into Asia, and into North Africa. Which means that no one person or no one group could have controlled the text at any one point in time. Why? Because if what David Cross said was correct, if you had popes and you had kings and you had scribes who wanted to insert things into the Bible, and they're in Turkey, what are they going to do with all the copies that are in North Africa? What are they going to do with all the copies that are into Central Europe? Well, they'd have to track them down and also alter them. But that would have been impossible. And so because of the history of the Bible, what's called the transmission, no one group or one person could have controlled the text at any one point in time. The objection for the translation doesn't work when we actually look at how we got the Bible. And likewise, the objection that people inserted things in the Bible that they wanted to or took things out also doesn't pan out when we look at how we got the history of the Bible. And not only that, but you might be thinking, okay, we're 2,000 years removed from the most recent books. We're even a few thousand years more removed from, say, some of the books in the Old Testament. So as time goes on, we're obviously getting farther away from the text, right? In one sense, of course. But in another sense, as time goes on, we're not necessarily getting farther from the original text. We're actually getting closer. What do I mean by that? Well, let me pick on the King James Bible for a second. The beloved King James Bible was translated between the years of 1604 and 1611. And it was translated not from manuscripts, those handwritten copies, but from printed editions of the Hebrew Old and Greek New Testaments. And the main printed editions that the King James translators use were based themselves on about 31 manuscripts. I'm talking about the New Testament here. Of the New Testament, the King James translators had 7 printed editions of the Greek New Testament, and those were based on approximately 31 manuscripts. Now, we have today 27 of those 31 manuscripts in our possession. We can go and we can look at them. But we also have 5,000 plus more manuscripts. If you skip ahead to 2023 from 1611, when the King James translation was published, we have a greater body of evidence that leads us back to the New Testament text and the Old Testament text. Because the earliest manuscript of those 31 that the King James translators had as their kind of underlying base text, the oldest of which was from the 11th century. Today, we have copies that go back to the 2nd century. So as time goes on, as we stick shovels in the ground and we discover manuscripts and we uncover archaeological evidence, we get closer to the time frame, to a picture of what the Bible actually said. Now, that doesn't mean that the King James translation is not accurate in that sense. If anything, what we found when we unearthed all those manuscripts is a confirmation that even though the King James translators were using a base text that came from a later period, it was remarkably similar, remarkably accurate. This is not a kind of a dig on the King James Bible, by no means. But what we have when we have modern translations is we're able to get a greater picture of what the original looked like. And all of those manuscripts, the oldest copies, ones that come from the 2nd, the 3rd, the 4th centuries, they've been discovered within the last 200 years. And this is one of the things that my colleague and I, Andy, went over to Egypt and are going to be producing that Can I Trust the Bible video series, talked about. We went to some of the places that those manuscripts were found. We went to places like Oxyrhynchus, Egypt, where the manuscript that's on the screen most likely came from. The manuscript that's on the screen is called P66. Now, scholars are very imaginative. So they said, what's it made out of? Papyrus. P. And how many do we have before this? 65. P66. Write it down in Latin because that sounds better. And now they have P66. Now, this is a very important manuscript because if you think about a book, Christians didn't invent the book, but they popularized it. The ancient world loved scrolls, but Christians loved codexes, books. Remember I said about Latin and academics? Codex means book in Latin, so an academic is going to call a book a codex. And so if you think about a book, the most vulnerable areas of the book are the front and the back. And we have a lot of middle of the books. And so if we're talking about, say, the Gospel of John, we lose a lot of the beginning and we lose a lot of the end. P66 is an almost entirely complete copy of the Gospel of John. And it comes from the late 2nd or early 3rd century. And if you read along with me on the screen, you can see... Anybody going to start? No? I'll make it easy for you. If you read along with me on the screen, it says... Not yet. It says at what we would consider John chapter 1, in the beginning was the Word, and the Word was with God, and the Word was God. He was in the beginning with God. All things were made through him, and without him was not anything made that was made. Does that sound familiar? I wonder why. It's because that's exactly what it says in your copy of the Gospel of John. Christians in the late 2nd, early 3rd centuries were reading exactly what you're reading. And we know that because we can go back into time, we can look at manuscripts like P66, and we can translate them and see what they were reading almost 2,000 years ago, 1,800 years ago, is what you're reading today. That's an incredible fact. Despite all of the accusations of translations of translations of translations, we can just go to the original languages. We can see what the early Christians were reading. And so for that reason, a description of the text of the Bible is not the telephone game. If anything, I want to pose to you that it's more like a 100,000-piece puzzle. If I were to give you a box of a 100,000-piece puzzle, and I were to say, okay, I want you to put this puzzle together, and you open it up, and you find that even though the box says it's 100,000 pieces, you open it up, would it be more annoying if you found that it had 99,900 pieces, or that it had 100,100 pieces? Well, it's both annoying. You're going to be mad at me either way. I apologize. But it's actually less annoying to have more. Less annoying to have more. Why would that be? Well, as you put the pieces together, as you find the ones that actually fit, you realize, because of the picture that's being made, that there are pieces that just don't belong. Or there are duplicate pieces. Or there are pieces from other puzzles. As the picture comes together and the image comes into view, you realize where some pieces just do not fit. And that is what we have with the Bible. Have there been scribal insertions into the Bible? Have people tried to alter things? Yes. And in that sense, we don't have 100% of the text of the Bible. We have 110% of the text of the Bible. Because the original is still in there. And because of all these copies, these 5,000 plus copies, when we put the picture of the puzzle together and we see the image, it is very easy to figure out what just doesn't belong. Or what's been added in, either intentionally or unintentionally. And if you're curious about those, open up your English translation of the Bible and look at the bottom of the page and find the textual notes. They'll tell you. We're transparent with this. We're not trying to hide anything. So the Bible isn't the telephone game. It's a 100,000-piece puzzle with 100,100 pieces. And because of the history of the Bible, we're able to pinpoint where those extra 100 pieces are. And we're able to render the text to exactly what the original authors wrote. And so based on that, we can say with confidence that what we have now is what the original authors wrote back then. We can. It's a fact. Now, some people might argue whether certain things are true or not, but it's a lot harder to argue that we don't have what the original authors wrote based on the history of the Bible.
So, has the Bible been changed? Well, no. The documents that you have in your Bible that you might have right sitting in front of you on the table are virtually unaltered from the time they were written. And the evidence for that is overwhelming. In fact, of all the ancient documents that we have, of all the ancient books and biographies and historical texts, the Bible has the highest level of trustworthiness of them all. So that's the first issue dealt with. The thing you have now is the same that was written 2,000 years ago. But that then asks the next question. Can we trust what was written 2,000 years ago? Is that a faithful account of, say, Jesus' life? Is it a trustworthy record? Or were the original authors making it up? Now, the New Testament, particularly the gospel accounts, they're written by people who claim to have been eyewitnesses to Jesus, or they're people who recorded the testimony of other people who were eyewitnesses to Jesus. And these gospels then become like sworn testimonies, right? Like in a courtroom. But are they telling the truth? Are they trustworthy? To answer this, let me tell you a bit of a story about a guy called Chuck. Chuck Colson was called Richard Nixon's hatchet man. Richard Nixon was the president of the US about 50 years ago, and Chuck was one of the 12 men who was aware of and around this cover-up scandal of what became known as Watergate. The Watergate scandal was named after the hotel where Republican employees or people paid by Republicans attempted to put surveillance equipment close to the political rivals of Richard Nixon. And it all went very wrong. They essentially got caught by the police. And then after that, some Republicans tried to cover it up. And it became a scandal. It was a crime. It would eventually cause Richard Nixon to become the only U.S. president to ever resign from office. Now, initially, only a few people, only 12 men knew about what had happened, knew about the Watergate issue. And there was a great question. Would they be able to keep their secret? Would they be able to protect their president? Would they be able to hold on to the lie? Now, listen to Chuck. There were no more than a dozen of us. Could we maintain a cover-up to save the president? Consider that we were political zealots. We enjoyed enormous political power and prestige. With all that at stake, you'd expect us to be capable of maintaining a lie to protect the president. But we couldn't do it. The first to crack was John Dean. First, he told the president everything, and then just 2 weeks later, he went to the prosecutors and offered to testify against the president. His reason, as he candidly admits in his memoirs, was to save his own skin. After that, everyone started scrambling to protect himself. What we know today as the Great Watergate cover-up lasted only 3 weeks. Some of the most powerful politicians in the world, and we couldn't keep a lie for more than 3 weeks. Now, listen to what Chuck says next. Can anyone believe that for 50 years, that Jesus' disciples were willing to be ostracized, beaten, persecuted, and all but one of them suffer a martyr's death without ever renouncing their conviction that they had seen Jesus' bodily resurrection? Does anyone really think that the disciples could have maintained a lie all the time under that kind of pressure? No, someone would have cracked, just as we did so easily in Watergate. Someone would have acted as John Dean did and turned state's evidence. There would have been some kind of smoking gun or a deathbed confession. So why didn't they crack? Because they'd come face to face with the living God. They could not deny what they'd seen. The fact is that people will give their lives for what they believe is true, but they will never give their lives for what they know is a lie. The Watergate cover-up proves that 12 powerful men in modern America couldn't keep a lie, and that 12 powerless men 2,000 years ago couldn't have been telling anything but the truth. So, back to Tim now. If someone says the writers of the New Testament were lying about Jesus, essentially what you're saying is that they were willing to go to their deaths, to suffer for years and years and years, to be persecuted and to let other people suffer and die for something they knew to be false. Here's a question. Is that plausible? Is that really that believable? Does that make sense to you? I know personally, I wouldn't last a minute under torture. I'm hardly willing to suffer for things that I know to be true. The Bible, particularly the New Testament, was written by people who died for what they believed to be true and who had an opportunity to know for sure. So let me put it all together. You can trust the original authors of the Bible. They were witnesses to the truth, and they stood by that truth through thick and thin. And then we can trust that we've got the faithful copies of what they originally wrote. You can trust the Bible as you have it. And so, today, while we're bombarded with marketing online scams, and we become used to being cynical about things that sound too good to be true, we need to be careful about God's message to humanity, that we aren't cynical about his message that he loves us, that he wants us to have true life, that's found in a relationship with Jesus. It might all sound a bit too much, but the evidence suggests that it is true. Jesus came into our world offering life to people that are looking for it in all the wrong places, and that's not a hoax. That is a faithful and good offer. So the question really is, have you checked out the evidence?
Well, thanks for that, Tim. We can trust the Bible. It's not a hoax. But what do you think? Here's a couple of questions to reflect on or to discuss with the people in the room. Have you read the Bible as an adult? And are you willing to trust what it says about Jesus? We'll give you a few minutes to talk. Feel free to pause it if you want some more time. Okay, hope that was long enough. We've got a couple of questions from last week.
Very good.
Tim, when I think about Christianity, I think about rules, things you can't do. Mm. How can a religion with so many rules and laws that says I can't do this, like you can't do that, be the answer to true fulfillment and happiness?
So I'm going to do the annoying thing and answer a question with a question. Is the freedom to do whatever you want, so is the absence of laws and rules the path to true happiness and satisfaction? Let me give you one example that shows how it's not.
Mm-hmm.
So the sexual revolution of the 60s said that sex is simply a physical act. It's meaningless. There's a modern kind of implication of saying that there is no God, that Christian rules or the Christian way of life is restrictive, oppressive. We needed to break out of that. We needed freedom from that. And therefore, go and have sex with whoever you want, however, you know, have sex particularly outside of marriage. You know, Christian Jesus encourages, not just encourages, commands, sex is for marriage. It was made for marriage. But sexual revolution, no, go and have it outside of the boundaries of sex as much as you can. Generally speaking, our culture has kind of taken that on, at least in Australia and so on.
Mm.
Now, has it made people happier?
Mm.
Has it made sex better? The statistics actually say no. People are having more sex, but it's not better and they're not happier for it. In fact, the people having the best sex turn out to be the people who've been married for longer than 15 years, because you need to feel emotionally safe with your sexual partner. It takes time to get comfortable, to know each other well. That's one piece of it. But now let's think of some of the other kind of more societal pieces. Think about the results of so much casual sex. We've got the prevalence of STIs. We've got unplanned and undesired pregnancies. We've got just the general devaluing of what sex is. Think about it this way. If sex is just a physical thing, then why shouldn't young men, for instance, pressure young women for sex?
Hmm.
It's a meaningless act after all. Go and have a read about what happened in some of the Sydney private schools in the last couple of years around this sort of male behaviour. And it's hard to tell them, no, sex is this really massive thing, when you've gone and said, no, it's this meaningless thing. The devaluing of Christian attitudes, rules, if you like, around sex, have they actually made sex better? Have they made it better for us and for our society? Here's, I think, the thing that I would suggest. What if sex is actually better if you keep it within the bounds, within some rules and laws, for instance, of marriage? Expand this out a little now. Mm-hmm. We all believe in laws. You actually like most laws.
Hopefully.
Unless you're a criminal, right? I'm glad that there are laws against stealing my stuff,
yep,
or attacking me on the street. These laws allow us to have a happier society. But what if Jesus's laws are the same? What if he actually knows us better than we know ourselves? What if his rules or commands are actually for our good? And yes, they may restrict you from some pleasures. But what if that's a good thing?
Hmm. Okay, last question. Does Jesus being the truth and the way mean that every other religion therefore is wrong? We're kind of a culture that is somewhat squeamish around truth claims like this, feels uncomfortable, and we don't like to work in absolutes. Because it might offend some people to say that Jesus is the only true way to happiness or to heaven or to God. That's offensive.
Yeah. And I think that is generally Aussie culture. We kind of step back from making these sort of statements, mm-hmm, or from people who make these sort of statements because it just feels too radical, too offensive.
Yeah.
But here's the first thing to see. Most religions, not all, but most, and certainly the biggest ones today, knock out all the other religions. So
yeah.
So look at it this way. If Islam is true, Christianity can't be true. If Buddhism is true, Islam can't be true.
Mm.
You cannot you cannot do any sort of faithfulness to any of these religions. You can't even be a serious person, I think, and say, oh, no, you can hold them all together. No, you can't. That is to actually kind of do violence to the beliefs of those religions. It's actually to be really offensive, to be honest, because their core beliefs just don't sit together. They actually stand at opposite sides.
Mm-hmm.
So it's impossible to say that Buddhism, Islam, and Christianity can all be true at the same time. Either none of them are true or one of them is. So someone's getting offended. The question is, which ones? The second thing to see is that Jesus does say, and I think mean, that other religions aren't the way or the truth. One of the things Jesus does, I think, so beautifully is he doesn't devalue the person seeking or their desire for what the thing that they're seeking after. So here's what I mean by that. John 4, John's gospel records a moment where Jesus meets a woman by a water well.
Mm-hmm.
She's a Samaritan woman. What that means is she follows a different religion to Jesus. They're related to a certain extent, but they're different. Now, Jesus doesn't do what sometimes we do. He doesn't say, hey, it's all good. You have your way. I've got mine.
Maybe we can merge them.
Yeah, maybe we can hold them together. He doesn't do that. But he also doesn't say to her, man, you're an idiot for being a Samaritan. what he does is he does this wonderful thing. He addresses her deepest longing, the thing that she, in many ways, is a Samaritan for.
Hmm.
He says, you came looking for something to drink at the well, but I can offer you living water that will satisfy your soul forever. And isn't that what we all want? And for her, the answer is yes, because we all want that. Why do people today check out Buddhism or Islam or whatever? Yeah, sure, maybe it's because they grew up with it. Fine, didn't have a lot of choice in that. But for a lot of people today, it's because they're looking for something bigger, something deeper than the materialism of our world, something that answers the deepest questions, our deepest longings. And Jesus doesn't condemn people for looking for those things. He just says, oh, that's not the right place.
Mm-hmm.
Come and find them in me. He's not saying you won't find anything in those other religions. I know lots of people who would say, oh, this religion was really helpful me in this way. Jesus isn't saying that that's not true. He's just saying that it's only him who can satisfy your deepest longings forever. These other religions may do something, may even do some things that are good for your life in a sense, but ultimately they won't satisfy your deepest longings like Jesus can, and they certainly won't do it into eternity.
Well, that's good news, I would say. So what does that mean for you? Have you looked into Jesus? Have you checked out the Bible or a church? And if your questions didn't get answered today, a reminder that you can find answers to many more questions on our podcast, Living Grounded. You can find that on Spotify or YouTube. We'll put the link down here on the website. And if you've got any more questions that you'd like Tim to answer, send them in. Here's the number, and we'll answer them in our next session when we wrestle with our biggest problem, a thing called sin. For now, we'll say goodbye. Until next session. Ciao.
See ya.